For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone. Today is nationally Martin Luther King Day, so I'm going to speak about Dr. King and the relevance of his teachings, as I do every year on this day. And I want to talk about Dr. King not as the kind of sanitized icon he's portrayed as, but how his spiritual teachings actually remain relevant to us and to our bodhisattva practice now. So bodhisattvas are enlightening beings. This is the Mahayana branch of Buddhism that Zen is part of. And we recognize through this that in our zazen, in our sitting, and in our practice, we're not just practicing for ourselves, although, you know, we do can benefit from this practice ourselves, but also we are deeply interconnected with all beings. So we sit together with all beings and for all beings. So Dr. King not only had a dream, which is what is he's now best portrayed as, but he strongly opposed the militarism and war of his time, of the Vietnam War. He championed the poor. He spoke strongly for economic justice. He was killed while he was organizing a labor union in Memphis for sanitation workers as part of his Poor People's Campaign. So again, he spoke strongly against the Vietnam War at a time that was difficult for him. He stood for strong, nonviolent resistance against oppression and modeled how we can do that. So these are all issues for American Buddhists today as well. Our Zen practice focuses on attention within, paying attention to this body and mind as we sit upright like Buddha, feeling what we feel, becoming more intimate with what this is on our seats. But also our awareness is expressed in bodhisattva vows, which we'll chant, and precepts and practices. So we see that work on ourselves includes work on the whole world. And work on the world helps work on ourselves. So Dogen, our 13th century founder in Japan especially, stressed the expression of Zazen, not just when we're sitting, but in our whole lives. So again, of course, Dr. King is best known for the I Have a Dream speech that he gave in April 1963 in Washington, D.C., which, you know, we chanted, may all beings be happy, may they be joyous and live in safety. So in some ways, this is part of the dream of Western Buddhists as well. He said, I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all people are created equal. So he called for justice, and that's part of our Zen practice too. Bodhisattva precepts talk about benefiting all beings. When we recognize that our karma is collective as well as individual, we see that we're related in terms of economic justice. So we chant all our ancient twisted karma, and it's about ourselves, but it's also about all of us collectively in our country and how we respond to the world. So in terms of economic justice in just to look at what's happening today, the new tax bill is a massive giveaway of economic resources from the American middle class to billionaires and from working people to the extremely wealthy. Dr. King was about tearing down walls between people, between races, between different classes. It was not about building walls. So one of the great accomplishments of the civil rights movement was the Voting Rights Bill of 1964, now being destroyed under systematic attack in many places in the country. So I'm giving a little history lesson. You know, a few of you may remember Dr. King. Most of you are too young to remember what he actually spoke for. So if we look at Dr. King's call for economic justice and social justice and equality and against wars, you know, we can look at what's happening now, thousands of children remaining in cages on the southern border. News this week was that this practice of separation and caging up children was going on long before it was first reported, and we don't know how many thousands are in cages now, thanks to our government. In terms of America today, racism and even slavery continues. It continues in the mass incarceration of many people, but especially young African Americans and other minorities. One horrible example is in California. The prisoners there have become firefighters against the major fires in California, and they're put on the front lines of the fire in the most dangerous places, and they're paid $1 a day. And when they get out of prison, they can't even get jobs they've been trained to do as firefighters because they're ex-felons. So, slavery continues in some way. Minority people's job opportunities and educational opportunities that Dr. King fought very hard for and gave his life for are now under attack from our government. There's ongoing murder of young black people by police. And despite courageous work and sacrifice by Dr. King and many others in the civil rights movement in the 60s, you know, this karmic long-term legacy of racism and slavery is deeply ingrained in our culture and in our ancient twisted karma. This is just the truth. But also Dr. King encouraged us, saying that our long-time work in the arc of history bends towards justice. So there's also possibilities in all the things happening today. There's also resistance to that. One year before he was killed to the day, April 4th, 1967, he gave a speech called Time to Break the Silence in New York City against the Vietnam War. At that time, I already had been working as a high school student in Pittsburgh for 2 years, demonstrating against the war. Muhammad Ali had come out against the war before that. But when Dr. King gave that speech against the Vietnam War and against the United States foreign policy, it was a great cost to himself as a civil rights leader. Many of his supporters didn't want him to do that. But he said that a time comes when silence is betrayal. Quote, we must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak. He also said, I must speak clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. And arguably, that's still the case. You may disagree, but Dr. King said, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. and the amount we spend on military defense today is much more and much higher proportion even than it was then. Dr. King said, America, the richest and most powerful nation in the world, can well lead the way in the revolution of values. There's nothing except a tragic death wish to prevent us from reordering our priorities so that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of wars. There is nothing to keep us from molding a recalcitrant status quo with bruised hands until we have fashioned it into a brotherhood. So today, still, our government creates violence. We have endless wars around the world. Soldiers ordered into many, many, many countries all around the world. Threats of nuclear attack made by our highest leaders. We're sponsoring genocide through famine and cholera and a cholera epidemic in Yemen through our weapons given to Saudi Arabia. This is quoting from the Endless Wars flyer that's out front that Charles Strain made a couple years ago. One key characteristic of empires and one cause of their collapse is endless warfare. Since the end of World War II, the United States has been involved in over 100 military conflicts. Excuse me. A Military Times article in 2015 estimated the costs of current conflicts at almost $5 trillion, and it's going up. And part of this is, this isn't just about military, it's also about climate, and leaders of our Congress and our executive now deny climate damage and are not doing the things that scientists say we need to do to make this better. There was news today that the Greenland ice sheets are melting much, much faster than the scientists had predicted. So it's a very serious problem. And yet our government, the wars we started in the Mideast with our invasion of Iraq and are not accepting refugees and are attacking immigrants who come from these wars encourages more terrorist attacks. Dr. King spoke of this as a sickness of the American heart. So, this is something that President Eisenhower warned a little before Dr. King's civil rights movement took off about the military-industrial complex. And now we have the military-industrial media context with the control of our government being under war profiteers and fossil fuel companies. The things that Dr. King warned us against are still very much relevant today, even more so. We need a Defense Department now to defend us against parts of our government. So I'm speaking the truth as I see it in the context of Dr. King saying silence is betrayal. He also said that the problem was not just the bad actions of bad people, but, quote, the appalling indifference of good people. So we need to respond. How do we do that? Dr. King gave wonderful lessons in how we do that. So his nonviolence was rooted in brotherly and sisterly love, agape from the Greek, loving your enemies. So some people resign themselves to the fate of oppression and acquiesce to things that are happening. But necessary, and it's not the way we help. Non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good, Dr. King said. So these times are challenging. I'll say more about agape in a minute, but we must not cooperate with oppression and fear. We must support people in our sangha and city and society who are being abused and oppressed. We must speak out against injustice. That's the meaning of Martin Luther King Day. Our bodhisattva vow, may all beings be happy, is what Dr. King was talking about. But there's not one right way to respond. Joanna Macy, one of my mentors, talked about three kinds of responses. One is just holding actions, which is all of the ways we try to mitigate the damage. Lobbying Congress people, lobbying the media to talk about climate damage rather than just talk about extreme weather as if it's, you know, just an ordinary event. So that's one kind of response, holding actions. Another is alternate systems, developing new ways of being in the world. That includes, you know, things like farmers markets and microbanks and alternative communities, sanghas. The third is changing our way of thinking, and that's what we're doing here. Sitting zazen changes our hearts and minds. Doing this practice regularly, being willing to stop and face the wall and see ourselves and find some settling and calming, but also see how to respond from that. So these are all ways of responding, and there's many ways of responding, and many people in our sangha are responding in various ways. I want to refer to an article that David Weiner wrote recently that's on our website in the articles page. He talks about how he lived in Chicago in 1966 and marched with Dr. Martin Luther King. Did anybody else here ever hear Dr. King? And I saw him on television, but I never saw him live. Anyway, David talks about having served as a housing tester, which meant that a white person, usually a college student, like I think David was then, or a young professional, would go just to look at an apartment that was available for rent, but not commit to rent the apartment. And then soon after, a black person with equal qualifications would go and check the apartment to see if it was still available. And often they were told not, that they couldn't rent it, that it was already taken. So this was one way that Dr. King worked in Chicago to reveal racial bias, not just in the South, but in the North too. And he had a very tough time in Chicago. David learned more, wrote this article partly based on having worked with Alan Sanocki at Upaya, where he was studying. And Alan Sanocki was here last November talking about this, about beloved community and about agape. So David says that agape, this brotherly love, is an unmotivated, spontaneous, overflowing that seeks nothing in return. Quote from Dr. King, the greatness of it is you love every person, not for your sake, but for their sake. It becomes the love of God operating in the human heart. Dr. King speaking from his Baptist context. You know, we can speak the truth about things that are happening and terrible things that are happening and some of the things I've mentioned, and there's so much more. But we can do that without name-calling, without hatred, without succumbing to hatred ourselves. So I heard from Paula, who's at Green Gulch Farm, doing an intensive this month, that Reb has been talking about repentance, and in that context, he's been speaking of evil as it applies in Buddhism. So I've said numbers of times that there's no evil in Buddhism, that we don't believe in evil in Buddhism, but I mean that like with a capital E, like there's some force of evil out there, you know, damaging us. But there are evil actions. So and even in our own hearts and minds, there are times when or even in our actions when we've caused harm. So we chant all our ancient twisted karma, and we now fully avow. This is a chant of repentance, and we can see that as our own harmful actions and those of the world. And to do this, you know, again, this thing about that Dr. King spoke about a lot and that Alan Sinocchi has spoken of and researched about beloved community. So David talks about that too. How can we bring out the best in each other? How can we fulfill our vows to embrace and sustain all beings? May all beings be happy. So this has to do with Sangha, community. And yesterday morning we celebrated the 10th anniversary of our being in this space, in this Zendo, which is wonderful. We all have many communities, but Sangha as a Dharma treasure means the ways in which community supports us, each of us, individually and together, to act helpfully and beneficially and to respond. So that's what we're doing here. And, you know, Dr. King was a Baptist, and that was his spiritual base, and we're doing following this Buddhist tradition, but really we're doing the same work. I want to add something today. There was a call upon Congress today that was sponsored by many prominent Americans. For example, Newton Farris Jr., who was a nephew of Martin Luther King and is past president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Reverend James Lawson also was part of this call. He was a close collaborator with Reverend King, very important person in the civil rights movement. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, children of Bobby Kennedy, also were part of this call. Others were Robert Blakey, who was the chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which determined in 1979 that President Kennedy was the victim of a probable conspiracy. How many people knew that? That the Congress actually investigated and determined that there was a conspiracy in President Kennedy's assassination? This isn't talked about by the mass media. I'm telling you about this because you're not going to hear about it in the mass media. Other people who were signing this call was Dr. Robert McClellan, who was one of the surgeons at Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas who tried to save President Kennedy's life and saw clear evidence that he had been struck by bullets from the front and the rear. Also, Daniel Ellsberg, that's a friend of mine, who did the Pentagon Papers and was national security advisor to the Kennedy White House. Richard Falk, professor emeritus in international law at Princeton, a leading global authority on human rights. Hollywood artists such as Alec Baldwin, Martin Sheen, Rob Reiner, and Oliver Stone. Also, David Crosby, the musician. Other people who signed this included Dr. Thomas Noguchi, who was the Los Angeles County Coroner, who performed the official autopsy on Bobby Kennedy. Also, Adam Walensky, who was one of the top aide and speechwriter of Senator Bobby Kennedy. And what they all called for, and others, was a calling on Congress for a new investigation into four assassinations of the 1960s. Assassinations of Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, and Bobby Kennedy. So today, Martin Luther King Jr. would have been 90 years old. This call by signed by all these people calls on Congress to establish firm oversight on the release of all government documents related to the Kennedy presidency and assassination mandated by the John F. Kennedy Records Collection Act of 1992. The public transparency law has been routinely defied by the CIA and other federal agencies. The current White House has allowed the CIA to continue its defiance of the law. The group statement also calls for a public inquest into the four major assassinations of the 60s that together had a disastrous impact on the course of American history, calling on them to start a tribunal that would include legal experts, still living witnesses, investigative journalists, historians, family members of the victims. Patterned after the Truth and Reconciliation hearings held in South Africa after the fall of apartheid. So this is intended to encourage Congress or the Justice Department to reopen the investigations into all four organized acts of political violence. You're probably not going to, as I said, you're probably not going to hear about this call that was issued today in the mass media, but and for that reason, I thought it was important to say something about it. As the public transparency campaign proceeds, citizens across the country will be encouraged to add their names to the petition. The national effort seeks to confront the forces behind America's democratic decline, a reign of secretive power that long precedes the recent rise of authoritarianism. Quote, the organized killing of John F. Kennedy, Malcolm, Martin, and Robert F. Kennedy was a mortal attack on our democracy. That's from historian James W. Douglas, who's author of a book called JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. That's a book that's in our library, and it's pretty compelling, and reading it will change everything you thought you knew about the last 50 years. Douglas says he's a Catholic worker, a spiritual person, and an historian, meticulously researched book. He says, we've been walking in the valley of the dead ever since. Our campaign is all about recovering the truth embodied in the movement that they led, those four men. The transforming, reconciling power of truth will indeed set us free. So just a little bit more about this. These four major assassinations in the 1960s together had a disastrous impact on the course of American history. The murders of John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and Robert F. Kennedy part of that I've already said. On Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we call for a full investigation of Reverend King's assassination. The conviction of James Earl Ray for the crime has steadily lost credibility over the years, with the 1999 civil trial brought by Reverend King's family placing blame on government agencies and organized crime elements. After the verdict, Coretta Scott King, Dr. King's widow, said, there is abundant evidence of a major, high-level conspiracy in the assassination of my husband. The jury in the Memphis trial determined that various federal, state, and local agencies were deeply involved in the assassination. Mr. Ray, James Earl Ray, was set up to take the blame. Reverend King's assassination was the culmination of years of mounting surveillance and harassment directed at the human rights leader by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and other agencies. As to Robert Kennedy, former Los Angeles County Coroner Dr. Thomas Noguchi, who performed the official autopsy on Senator Kennedy, said the forensic evidence alone establishes that the shots fired by Sirhan Sirhan, who was been convicted and is assumed as, and the official version is that he was the lone assassin, that the shots he fired from in front of Senator Kennedy did not kill him. The fatal shots struck Robert Kennedy in the head were fired at point blank range from behind. So this is just a little bit about this. And again, I mentioned the 1979 Congressional Committee that said that there was a conspiracy in President Kennedy's murder. Robert Kennedy believed that the assassination of his brother was a conspiracy. And other things that very well documented in that JFK and the Unspeakable book, that his administration was badly fractured over the efforts for the Cold War. Kennedy has long been portrayed as a Cold War hawk, but that's not really true. That's grossly inaccurate. He was involved in back-channel peace feelers to the Soviet Union, working together secretly with Nikita Khrushchev, secret from their own militaries, and with Cuba to plan withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam after the 1964 presidential election. Maybe that's enough of this, but I'm mentioning it today just because you're not likely to hear it anywhere else, and because it was posted on as part of a response to Martin Luther King Day. And again, history and time. And I talked about time yesterday in terms of our 10th anniversary. We're maintaining and sustaining a practice that goes back 2,500 years to the Buddha and 800 years to Dogen, and that has been sustained through all that time. And it helps to have a wide sense of time. But also, it helps to have to know history. And by sanitizing who Dr. King was in the popular media, we're losing our sense of history. So I'm speaking this to you and to all those who might listen to the podcast as a corrective to that, because our practice is about facing the truth. Facing many truths, but when we see the present in terms of the context of our past and our possible futures, it informs us about how we may respond now, today. So that's a lot of information. And again, it's not a traditional Dharma talk, citing sutras and Zen stories, but this is the Zen story of our time in the last 50 years. So I'll stop there. Comments, questions, responses? Anyone have any questions about who Dr. King was? Yes, Jan, hi.
My question is about what that call was. He said it went into Congress yesterday.
Today.
It went in today.
It's a public call for a thorough investigation, reinvestigation of this, sponsored by numbers of people. I can send you the link to the. There's an article in Consortium News that details it. But if you email me, I'll send you information about it. So this is our current Congress is not likely to respond to this. But just to put this information out changes what we know about the world we're in, the historical world we're in. So this, to me, this isn't about politics, This is about how do we see our world? How do we respond to it? This has been kept, this information about the assassination has been kept secret through various administrations. It's not just about our current government, although there are many terrible things our current government is doing, in my opinion. Other comments? Yes, Jen. Please.
Thank you. we have done this in our country. We're not the only ones who have enslaved people and sold children. And we did it to the Africans, and we did it to the Native Americans.
Yes.
Now, when I say we, I mean, I don't know what I mean. the people who did it in our name.
Yes.
And so if we don't, the truth and reconciliation is a comfort, or it is, what is the truth? And then there's the reconciliation, which means that we are attempting to reconcile this past and go on to a new kind of future. Am I getting that?
Yeah, well, what happened in South Africa, this was part of, after the end of our apartheid, they had, you know, extensive hearings to look into what had happened during apartheid. And in that case, to find a kind of peace and integration, reconciliation, you know, there's the question of how do you hold people accountable? The fossil fuel companies who knew about climate damage and did nothing for, you know, decades now, for example. But how do we make peace with this? It depends on knowing the truth. So that's what they're calling for, and all the people I mentioned and many others. Yes, Aishin.
This stuff has been covered over for years, and we just keep building on the, you know, covered over versions. I don't know how to say it in a way that isn't pessimistic, you know? Like,
I'll try and turn what you say. Go ahead.
What makes anyone think that anything good can come out of this? Maybe nobody thinks that, but we have to keep trying anyway. Maybe that's what I'm kind of getting at, is we have to continue to try, but it seems doubtful that we can ever gain clarity into things that were purposely obscured 50 years ago and have been purposely obscured for the past 50 years, and we've built more things on top of them that have been purposely obscured.
Good, yes, exactly. And the truth is available. So look at that James Douglas book, JFK and the Unspeakable. That's available. People can know. Actually, Joanna Macy insisted that I read that. That's why I read it. So it's not just me recommending it. But and there was this 1979 congressional. Did I get the right date on that? I get my numbers mixed up, but this congressional investigation actually officially, let me get the date right. They officially stated that there had been a conspiracy in the assassination of President Kennedy.
And then conspired not to tell anybody about it until
they did. It wasn't hidden. It was public. That's a public fact. And our mass media doesn't talk about that. When we talk about President Kennedy, there's all kinds of other things. President Kennedy was trying to wage peace in his last 6 months, and that may have been why he was killed. So again, I encourage you strongly to read JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas, two S's at the end. I can't find what year that was. That I don't know if it was 79 or 97. It must have been 79. That they the House of Representatives panel actually stated that it was a conspiracy, not just Oswald acting alone. So this information is available, and I'm talking about it because you didn't know about that. How many people knew about that congressional investigation?
It was in the news, but not for any length of time.
Right, but you heard about it.
And it was sort of viewed as poppycock.
Yeah, well,
it's characterized as such, even but with intention, I feel.
Yeah. So, conspiracy theories are considered, you know, psychotic or something, but there have been real conspiracies. The Congress even said so. Their investigation. Go ahead, Ed.
And it does stand to reason that it was a larger picture that bore down on such fearless men at such a challenging time in our political history. I would assume that it couldn't simply be an aberrant behavior of a single individual in any of those cases. And it brings me to a question of meditation of just human of fear. Because you try to determine how is it that truth is always such a discrete quantity in the world. And typically, well, buried behind safety concerns or comforting notions of imagination that the imagination provides us both in the community and as individuals. What role does fear play? What is the role of fear in both the individual desire to not to believe the truth that we similar tendencies? And so it's not as if what happened in 1968 is any different than what happened in 600 BC in Athens or Sparta or other noted nodes of Western civilization, Persia and so forth. This is a continuing paradox of the human heart. And well, we unfortunately had one. As our generation, I mean, I'm, you know, the 60s were an awful, 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 awful time.
They were a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time in many ways. I was there. I remember.
All right, one and the same, of course.
And just to respond a little bit to Ed, and then I'll call on you, Ashton. But yeah, it's true that these things happen. It's true that conspiracies happen. I mean, the Tonkin Gulf incident that precipitated the Vietnam War, like the supposed uranium cakes in Iraq that allowed George W. Bush to start his invasion that's caused massive wars in the Mideast since. You know, these things happen. Knowing the truth changes how we can respond. Knowing the truth changes, and things do change. Apartheid ended. The Berlin Wall came down. Soviet Union ended. We don't know how these changes happen. In all those three cases, experts on those things wouldn't have predicted it a couple months before. So things happen suddenly after lots and lots of work. So the work is exposing the truth. Part of it, part of the work. Changing our way of thinking from aggression and competition and all of that to cooperation. And this is, so in terms of Joanna Macy's three aspects of change, part of that is what we're doing here through Zazen, changing our ways of thinking, and it takes a while. And so Dr. King talked about the arc of history bending towards justice, but it's a long process. And we have something to give to that as Zen people, because we have a context of seeing, you know, 2,500 years ago to Buddha, 800 years ago to Dogen. Yesterday I mentioned that Lake Michigan is 14,000 years old in terms of when the last glacier left and left us Lake Michigan. So, you know, there's different ranges of time. When we see that, we can feel the fierce urgency of now, as Dr. King said, about the Vietnam War, and as we could say about climate and the existential threats. Okay, enough. Asian.
Well, you already said it, actually, but what I was going to say was that in fear and truth and freedom is exactly where practice can help in our own lives, but also help as we help the people around us to recognize ways in which we all are afraid, we all are buying into cultural illusions, we're all on a treadmill to one extent or another, and it doesn't have to be about opening people's eyes about politics. That's your gift. But actually just opening people's eyes at all, opening people's eyes to an awareness that they are suffering is, and what it feels like for a moment to not be suffering, in whatever way they are, is a way that we can bring about that kind of change. Because once people see what it feels like to recognize that you're suffering and not buy into it anymore and not be suffering, people will buy into our cultural delusions a lot less.
And fearlessness doesn't mean not having fears. It means seeing our fears and acting anyway. And the suffering and fear is personal for each of us on our seat. And also, you know, what was happening in the 60s and what Dr. King called for, what Bobby Kennedy called for towards the end of his life, what John Kennedy was working for towards the end of his life, what Malcolm X was working for towards the end of his life when he saw that it didn't have to be. He was breaking down the walls of black versus white because he went to Mecca and he saw, you know, if he had lived, how would Islam as a whole around the world have changed? Okay, these were all possibilities that were there in the 60s, and there were lots of other possibilities in the 60s, and this violence happened. And to see that the violence happened not just by isolated, you know, madmen, but in a context that is part of the context of all of our cultural problems now, is to awaken to something. So it does affect us personally. It's not separate. Dylan.
Yeah, I'd like to add that never to underestimate the strength of teamwork and love. It's true that state violence has been a way that societies have suffered through time. But it is not always so. But there are,
right,
are times where people work together. Find means of solidarity in ways that can exemplify that you can work together and build something that works and keeps you alive and keeps you healthy with other people and have a loving community. You know? And it's easy for that faith to eroded through this kind of stuff, you know, but Mandela was in that prison for how many years?
I don't know how many years, but he was a long time, and he eventually became president. Yeah.
30 years, you know, and he didn't give up, you know.
And what you're talking about is exactly what happened with this civil rights movement in the 60s. That Dr. King was only one of the people who inspired it. There were many, many people, courageous people, Rosa Parks, and, you know, this is a long list, who developed beloved community, were not afraid, but, or maybe they were afraid, but they faced their fear. They walked across that bridge. And, yeah, through what Dr. King called agape, through love, community, through being willing to face fears, by being willing to face the truth, and that's what that call is about. So it's not just something that happened 50 years ago. There are movements today. The teachers on strike for in Los Angeles and recently in Oklahoma and in Arizona and West Virginia for facilities for their students. Many, many, many movements going on now. Black Lives Matter movement. People are working for social justice and love. And what one of the lessons of Dr. King is, though, is that if we turn that into hatred, we, you know, it's easy to feel hatred. David Weiner talks about that in his article, which is on our website now. If we turn that into hatred of the, you know, whoever we think of as the bad guys, the people who are doing evil actions and harming people, if we turn that into hatred, then we become like that, and we don't have to. We can act and respond and look at the truth without becoming hatred ourselves. And that does change things. And it doesn't mean that there is not horrible damage and suffering that happens. But, you know, the arc of history bends towards justice is this famous phrase from Dr. King. And, you know, sometimes we can feel like that's debatable, but we can also see, you know, that there are some things that are better. I mean, we had an African-American president. We have African-American women running for president for the next time. Anyway, yeah, I'm sorry. I'll get off my soapbox. Other comments? Caitlin, do you have any reflections on this or responses?
Actually,
I thought so. I saw that. I'm sorry, I couldn't. Yeah, that's a good word. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, we're a little, more than a little beyond time, but this is so important. Katie, did you have something you wanted to say? No? Okay. So, happy Martin Luther King Day. And let's continue to try and be aware. And we'll close with our team song.